Okay, so maybe we will get started. My name's Bhante Sujata. Welcome to the session we call Monks in Space, because this is a space. I don't know. So, Bhante Sujata, we're here today in Parramatta on the land of the Burramattagal people of the Darug Nation, who are the traditional custodians of this land and who looked after this land according to their own reckoning from time immemorial. And we know that when the white folk arrived here, that the contemporary accounts by the white settlers describe a park-like environment where you could ride your horses under the trees and where it was full of lush plants and growth and animals everywhere. And safe to say, we managed to put an end to all that. And now it's lots of concrete and cars. So that's what we call progress. Okay. But in any case, the rights of the land have never been ceded. And for those of you who are from overseas or not familiar with Australian history, when the white folk arrived in Australia, they invented this legal fiction called terra nullius, empty land, by which they declared that there was no people living on the land and they could just have it. Of course, there was like a million people or something here at the time, but they didn't count. So that legal fiction was overturned subsequently, but that was what the sort of legal fiction on which the Australian nation state was founded. Anyway, so we are here today on their land and pay respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging, and recalling their struggles to maintain the integrity of the land. There was great battles in Parramatta, led by Pumulwe, was the local rebel leader. And I just mentioned that because today we saw the announcement of a ceasefire in Gaza and saw the celebrations of the people and the folks there in Gaza. And that whole war and genocide has been a horrifying situation for the last couple of years. And who knows what is going to happen, in the future. But for now, it seems that there's a determination for peace, and peace is always better than the lack of peace. And hopefully the UN will be able to get some aid to Gaza, much needed aid, as quickly as possible, and hopefully we can move towards a more permanent solution. Anyhow, today we are going to begin with some chanting, so we can pass out our chanting sheets for anybody who needs them. Oh, do we have chanting sheets? We do? Yep. We can pass out our chanting sheets for anyone who needs them, and we are going to do some meditation for anybody who needs meditation. Pretty much everyone, I think. And we're going to then have a bit of a Dhamma talk and maybe time for some questions and that kind of thing. So I really want this to be a space that everybody feels welcome and that you can relax and feel a sense of uplift, that we can turn our minds towards that which is most meaningful and most valuable. Okay, we are ready? Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi buddham saranam gacchami.
Dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Iti piso bhagavarahaṁ sammāsambuddho vijjācharana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarathi sattha deva manusanam buddho bhavati. Svakato bhagavata dhammo sandhikho akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko pachatam veditabbo vinyuhiti. Supatipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho ujupatipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho nyayapatipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho Samichi patipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho Iyadidam chathari purisa yugani Artha purisa pungala Esa bhagavato sahavaka sangho Ahuneyo, pahuneyo, dakirneyo, anjali karaniyo, anutaram punyaketa lokasati.
Amazing. You can hear the resonant voice. It's true, though. Sorry?
With more people chanting, it's like, whoop, uplifting.
I know it is, right? Yeah. Especially if they can chant well. It's good. All right, so... One, I don't know if you've met any Buddhists, but Buddhists are typically very weird people. So one of our favorite activities is to come along and meet all of our friends and everyone and just sit in a room together, not talking to each other. Like for most people, that's like a sign that there is something like weird and wrong. For us, it's a sign that everything is right with the world. And if you can just sit in a room with all of the people that you love the most and the people you care about the most and just sit there quietly together and not say anything, then that's regarded as being so beautiful and so nice. So for this meditation that's going to be coming up in a minute, we're going to be taking the opportunity to join together and to sit quietly. Here in Sydney, it's been a hot day. Summer is coming early. And the sun is now setting. It's that kind of tranquil time of the day. The birds are chirping outside. Probably the bats are flying as well. And so it's a nice time of the evening. And all of the day's activities, all of those unanswered emails, all of those undone shopping or things that should have been cleaned or things that bits of work that should have been done, all of those, don't have to worry about them till tomorrow. It's all right. Yeah, it's the weekend coming up. You don't have to worry about them till Monday. Hey. So right for now, we don't have to worry about anything. We have ourselves. We have our minds. We have our bodies. We have our feelings, we have our thoughts, have our memories, our intentions. That's quite a lot already. So we could just take care of those things for now, and we don't have to worry about everything happening around outside us. So when we meditate, we take the opportunity to allow our mind to settle into the present, to allow our awareness to, like, almost like become friends with and to just inhabit peacefully in our body. Like normally we're driven by this kind of restlessness. We sort of want to see something, want to do something, where we want to get something, want to have something. And we can't just be. And it's amazing how powerful that is. Just that capacity to simply be, to not want anything, to not lack anything, to not need anything. It's the most powerful thing in the world. Like everybody these days, people talk about like the evils of capitalism or something like that. Imagine if people were just content. Capitalism would collapse overnight. I don't know what would happen then. That would be unexpected, whatever it was going to be then. But so much when you start to think what the reality is of simply being content, it's a profound shift in the way that you relate to the world. So for the meditation, the key to Buddhist meditation is the understanding that while it is true that we are often agitated and disturbed and restless, and that that is a natural state of the mind, it is also true that it is natural for the mind to tend towards peace. The Buddha gave beautiful similes like the rain that would fall on the mountaintop and form into puddles, and the puddle form into little rivulets, into streams, and the streams into rivers, and the rivers would flow down to the great ocean. And so there's this idea that somehow our mind just naturally is settling. And so the process of meditation is not the process. Like often what meditation is people are like, okay, what's the solution? The problem is the water is on the mountaintop and we need it in the ocean. What's the solution? Well, I'll go up to the mountaintop with a bucket, scoop up the water, and then trudge down to the ocean and pour it into the ocean. That's how we'll get that done. And so that's how a lot of people seem to approach meditation. So if you think of your mind as being a natural system, we've been talking a lot about dependent origination these past weeks. So this is all about how our mind is a natural system within the wider natural system of nature as a whole. And so in this natural system of the mind, there is a tendency to move towards peace, tendency to move towards stillness. And this is in physics, they just call this entropy. Everything just moves. I hope that's correct, Mike. I've never entirely sure if I've understood entropy correctly, so please fix me if I'm wrong. But anyway, so the things tend to move towards a dissipation of energy. So this is, and that brings about a state of balance and a state of clarity in the mind. Okay, so to get there, right, so the problem is, so again, if I'm going to perhaps belabor this metaphor of the mountaintop and the streams a little bit further, the problem is not that the water doesn't want to flow down to the ocean, right? I mean, we say, obviously water doesn't want to flow down to the ocean, right? But it's as if it does. It's the same thing with your mind. Your mind wants to become peaceful. Your breath wants to calm you down, just like the water wants to flow to the ocean. But the reason it doesn't is not because of any problem with the water. It's not because of any problem with the mountain. It's not because of any problem with the ocean. It's because we built a dam. It's because we broke it. We broke the system of nature. And because we broke the system of nature, then we have to try to do something to restore that natural system. So if we have built up those dams in the mind, by which I mean all of the habits and the bad habits and the repression and denial and all of that kind of stuff which has created and distorted the fabric of our mind. So to allow our mind to smooth out and to come to rest and to dissolve all of those tensions, we need to kind of nudge it in that way as gently as we can, but without like forcing it. And so sometimes we need to point our mind in a certain direction that will lead towards it becoming peaceful. So normally what we do then is we do mindfulness of breathing meditation. So breath is a energy, an activity, a flow, which is constantly happening in your body, but it is also an emotional and a cognitive reality. It's not just a physical thing. Breath has all of these dimensions of life and consciousness to it as well. So when we bring our attention to the breath, the physical presence of the breath naturally serves to calm us down, and it has an integrating and tension-dissolving function. So by bringing the attention to the breath, we're allowing the breath to do its natural job of resolving the conflict and tensions within us. And it leads to a wholeness, initially a wholeness and a tranquility of the breath and of the body, but also wholeness and tranquility of the mind, and an integration of the mind, the cognition, the emotions, and the physical dimensions of the breath as well. So this is how the practice of mindfulness of breathing works, by working with the flow of nature. Let's do some meditation for the next 20 minutes or so. Letting your body settle into your chair. opening the mind to the experiences that are going on, and feeling the gentle sensation of the breath as it comes in and the breath as it goes out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. When your mind wanders off to this and that, just don't pay it any attention. Don't give it any importance. It's okay. Minds do that. It's just normal. You realize that, okay, that's what my mind's doing. Recognize where your mind is going. Hold it for a minute. And then just come back to the pleasant, calming sensation of the breath coming in and the breath going out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Now, coming to the end of the meditation, and bringing the mind back into the senses around us, and taking a minute to review back over the meditation, inquiring into cause and effect. Ask yourself, what was that like? How did my mind change? What stopped happening during that meditation? What kept going? How does my breath feel like now? Does it feel softer, warmer, cooler? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good. Let's have a break for a couple of minutes, grab a cup of tea. I'll come back for the final talk on dependent origination. Okay, very good. So welcome back, everybody. So this week is the final teaching on dependent origination. That's how I'm feeling right now, getting revved up. Revved up. So for those of you who are overseas, that is a local, like Australian species that we call a bogan. And but Parramatta actually traditionally was the habitat of the bogan, the main habitat of the bogan. In recent years, it's got a gentrification and multiculturalism and so on has almost all but driven the traditional bogan out into fields further west, but as you can see, we're not still completely lacking. Anyway, moving along. Okay, got a few questions here. Diriyupa asks, Ajahn, are you finished doing annotations for the Samyutta Nikaya, or if so, or what have you finished doing? I'm still doing the Samyutta. I'm at the moment doing the annotations for the Salayatana Samyutta, so that means I'm about halfway through. I was just doing that this afternoon, a little bit of that this afternoon. So for those of you who are not familiar, so I did my translations of all the suttas a few years ago, and for this current period, I'm working back through all of my translations in detail and writing annotations for all of them, which is a project that's going to take several years. I've currently finished the Digha and Majjhima, and I'm going through the Samyutta Nikaya, and I'm publishing them on Sutta Central as they're completed. So this one will be completed in a couple of weeks, probably. There's the Salayatana Samyutta, and then I'll keep on going. All right. So Karma asks a silly question: is there any significance to a monk's robe being finally folded on the left or right shoulder? Traditionally, we put them all on the left shoulder, and the right shoulder is always exposed. That's just always the traditional way that it's worn. There we go. We've got an answer from Venerable Pasanda: wearing the robe on the left shoulder leaves the right hand free. It's a right-handed world. This is true. People would have carried the weapons on the right side. Sign of respect to arrange your robe to show you unarmed, or at least that's my dodgy theory. So excellent dodgy theory, Venerable. Oh, by the way, that reminds me, next week I'm going to be away, but Venerable Pasanna is going to be here. So the talk will continue as always. I'll be away on retreat. I'm doing a retreat for ABCAP, and I'll be absent from here, but the talk will continue as always. Wednesday night, however, at Crow's Nest will be cancelled this week. So that's just one week we're cancelling. As it happens, the venue was otherwise booked this week anyway, so we couldn't use the venue. And I'm also going to be away. They're doing the HSC at the venue this week. And also just to let you know, while we're on the subject, that for next week, if anybody's bringing bindabata, bringing alms food, then I'll be away on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of next week. Okay. Great. Okay. Venerable Tamakipa asks, who is the nice lady with the contagious laugh? I think that's Moo. Okay. Oh, that's right. And while we're at it, yes, Santi Forest Monastery Katina is on this Sunday, on the 12th. The Lankarama Katina in Schofields is on tomorrow. And the Our Katina, or robe offering ceremony, is on the 25th. Right, 25th. So that's on the Lokanta website. So check it out to join the community for that end of rains ceremony. Venerable Dhammakipa, are you having a ceremony this year?
No, there won't be a ceremony here because I'm the only one here at the moment and still trying to get things going at the Vihara. So right. No ceremony.
Okay. Yeah. No ceremony. Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Next time.
Next time, next year, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so back to the topic of dependent origination. So for the last several weeks, we've been discussing this topic, and we have briefly sum up the content. We began by looking at the basic definitions and idea, the fundamental concepts. Then we looked at the cultural context and background for dependent origination. Then we looked in more detail at the grammar and the structure of how it works and how it's expressed. Then we looked at some of the shorter discourses on dependent origination to look at how the Buddha would present it in different ways, in different contexts. We ventured as far as looking at the Kacchayanagata Sutta, perhaps one of the Buddha's most insightful and profound statements on that topic. And we then looked at briefly at the teachings of Nagarjuna and the Mula Madhyamaka Karika, who drew on the teachings of the Kacchayanagata Sutta. Finally, last week, we looked at some of the erroneous interpretations of dependent origination, debunking a few myths and so on. So that was last week. Oh, no, that was week before last. And then last week, we began to look at the practical application of dependent origination, and we looked at some of the basic suttas that point to the fact that this is not just a theory, but it's something which is supposed to be practiced and something supposed to be realized. So for today, we're going to continue on that theme, and we're going to be looking at one discourse in particular, and that's Sanyutta Nikaya number 12.23, the Upanishad Sutta. So I'm just popping that into the chat for those of you who are online. Oh, and by the way, just a reminder for those folks who are online, if you can turn your cameras on, that's good. Then I can see who you are. Yay. All right. So the Upanishad Sutta. So this is a very quite unique and interesting discourse that links up the teachings of the theoretical teachings of dependent origination with the teachings on the path in a very beautiful way. Let me, as usual, read through the sutta in translation to begin with and then go back and discuss it in some more detail. At Savati, mendicants, I say that the ending of defilements is for one who knows and sees, not for one who does not know or see. For one who knows and sees what? Such is form. Such is the origin of form. Such is the ending of form. Such is feeling. Such is perception. Such are choices. Such is consciousness. Such is the origin of consciousness. Such is the ending of consciousness. The ending of the defilements is for one who knows and sees this. I say that this knowledge of ending has a vital condition. It doesn't lack a vital condition. And what is it? You should say freedom. I say that freedom has a vital condition. It doesn't lack a vital condition. And what is it? I say dispassion. You should say dispassion. I say dispassion has a vital condition, and what is it? You should say disillusionment. I say disillusionment has a vital condition, and what is it? You should say truly knowing and seeing. I say that truly knowing and seeing has a vital condition, and what is it? You should say immersion, samadhi. I say immersion has a vital condition, and what is it? You should say bliss. I say that bliss has a vital condition, and what is it? You should say tranquility. I say that tranquility has a vital condition. What is it? You should say rapture. I say rapture has a vital condition, and what is it? You should say joy. I say joy has a vital condition, and what is it? You should say faith. I say faith has a vital condition, and what is it? You should say suffering. I say that suffering has a vital condition, and what is it? You should say rebirth. I say rebirth has a vital condition. What is it? Continued existence, bhava. I say continued existence has a vital condition, and what is it? Grasping. Grasping is a vital condition. What is it? Craving. I say craving has a vital condition, and what is it? Feeling. And then contact, since six sense fields, the name and form, consciousness and choices. I say that choices have a vital condition. They don't lack a vital condition. And what is the vital condition for choices? You should say ignorance. And so, mendicants, ignorance is a vital condition for choices. Choices are the vital condition for consciousness. Consciousness is the vital condition for name and form. Name and form are the vital conditions for the six sense fields. The six sense fields are the vital conditions for contact. Contact is a vital condition for feeling. Feeling for craving. Craving for grasping. Grasping for continued existence. Continued existence for rebirth, rebirth for suffering. Suffering is the vital condition for faith. Faith is the vital condition for joy. Joy is the vital condition for rapture. Rapture is the vital condition for tranquility. Tranquility is the vital condition for bliss. Bliss is the vital condition for immersion. Immersion is the vital condition for truly knowing and seeing. Truly knowing and seeing is a vital condition for disillusionment. Disillusionment is a vital condition for dispassion. Dispassion is a vital condition for freedom. Freedom is a vital condition for the knowing of, for the knowledge of ending. It's like when the heavens rain heavily on the mountaintop and the water flows downhill to fill the hollows, crevices, and creeks. As they become full, they fill up the pools. The pools fill up the lakes fill up the streams fill up the rivers, and as the rivers become full, they fill up the ocean. In the same way, ignorance is a vital condition for choices, and all the way till freedom is the vital condition for the knowledge of ending. So this is the Upanishad Sutta. And as you can see, it includes that simile of the rivers flowing down from the mountaintops, thus proving that I'm not just making this stuff up. And we can see, oh, Sinsin, welcome. Come, no, just missed all the boring bits. You're good. So let's go back over the discourse. So to briefly just sum up the summary of the discourse. First thing that we can notice is that this is a general teaching. It's not given to a particular person, right? So it's not like, say, the Kacchanagata Sutta for a particular individual. It's a general teaching. Second thing that's interesting is that it begins with the teaching on the five aggregates, which it's fairly rare to find teachings on the five aggregates with the dependent origination, but here both of them are found. Then we can notice that when dependent origination is presented, it's presented first of all in reverse order, right, from knowing and seeing and freedom, and then working its way back. And then the recapitulation is then in forward order. So these are all just some details of the structure. But then the other detail is the word Upanishad, which I'm translating here as vital condition. And we'll come, and that's obviously the key term in this particular discourse. So we'll come on to that in just a minute. To sum up the message of the sutta, the idea here, one of the crucial links is the link between suffering and faith, right? So normally the Buddha's like, here you are, you've landed in it. Ah, right? But here, somehow, out of that pain, we rest something positive, some faith. And that is like a key that leads us from suffering towards freedom. I mean, there's a number of implications to that. One implication is that you can't be free unless you suffer, which is not an invitation to suffer more, because most of us have plenty already. But it is interesting. This kind of speaks a little bit to what some of the things that Nagarjuna was pointing out, like you can't, like that Nibbana is only possible because samsara is possible. Okay, the beginning of the sutta says, the ending of defilements is for one who knows and sees, not for one who does not know or see. So a couple of terms here worth commenting on. First of all, the term the ending of defilements, asavakaya, is a common term in the suttas for arahantship. Okay, now the translation of this is one of those terms a little bit tricky to translate. I translate it as the ending of defilements. Bhikkhu Bodhi has, I think, the destruction of the taints. Is that right? Something like that, which I don't like. It's a great translation, except for the bit about the destruction and the bit about the taints. So apart from that, it's a great translation. So the problem is that kaya doesn't mean destruction. Like, it never means destruction. There are a bunch of perfectly good words in Pali to refer to destroy something. Kaya is not one of them. Kaya is always used in the sense of the waning of the moon or the drying up of a stream or the using up of supplies, right? So it's when something is being used up or evaporated or waning or coming to an end, right? It has a much more gentle feeling to it than destruction, right? I mean, the Buddha used strong language. I'm not saying the Buddha wouldn't use strong language. He did. But in this particular case, kaya has quite a gentle feeling to it. You know, it's the quieting of suffering because the fuel is no longer there. So I've translated in this context as the ending. I would like to translate it as the evaporation. But I'm not bold enough to do this. Anyhow, Nyan Moli translates. Sorry?
It's not body.
No, this is a different word. Kaya as opposed to kaya. Aspirated, non-aspirated. So asava is also another one which has fun translations like fermentations and cankers and what are some other ones? I don't know what Denisra is using these days. I think he used to use fermentations or outflows or inflows. So there's outflows, there's inflows, there's cankers, there's fermentations. I don't know, there's a few others, taints, Bhikkhu Bodhi has. But I don't really like any of those. I can go through the reasons why I don't like them. I don't like the taints because it's like something's basically okay, but like it's a bit not. Well, it's not really what an asava is. The idea that it means fermentations is really kind of overblown rendering of some meaning in a different context. Actually, the context of asava as a technical term is shared with the Jains, and with the Jains it has a much more clearly defined technical sense. So for the Jains, they believe that the jiva or the soul is intrinsically pure and clear, like a gem, and it is polluted by karma or by asavas. For Jains, these are the same thing, which is like a physical, like a literal physical pollution that clouds the soul and clouds the mind, right? This is how the Jains consider it. So that even though from a Buddhist point of view, we don't think about the soul and so on and so forth the same way, but it's a similar kind of metaphorical point. It's something which is a corruption or a pollution or a defilement, right? Something which is darkening. So that's why I've translated as defilements and I translate kilesa as corruption. Okay. Knowing and seeing. Also, this is important to realize. This is a technical term in Buddhism. Okay. So whenever we see terms like knowing and seeing or truly knowing and seeing, or and there's various variations of it that are very kind of emphatic, like reiterations, especially this knowing and seeing, this usually refers to, it invariably refers to some kind of deep insight, but it usually refers to at least stream entry. Okay, so in this particular case, obviously it's referring to arahantship because it's the ending of the defilement. So knowing and seeing is always a profound term. And as we can see in this sutta, that knowing and seeing emerges from samadhi. Again, this being very standard in the suttas. Okay, so one who knows and sees what? And the five aggregates, the origin and the ending of the five aggregates. I won't go into the five aggregates for tonight. But we'll just, because that would just take too much time. We're moving on. So then I say this knowledge of ending has a vital condition, doesn't lack a vital condition. So the word here for vital condition is upanisar. So upanisar is a specific term used for a condition in Buddhism. So we've already seen while looking through dependent origination that this notion of causality and conditionality can be expressed in multiple different ways, so that there are the grammar in which we talk about it is quite important. And this word upanisar has a particular kind of connotation in Pali and in the Buddhist texts. So the connotation is that it is both necessary and strongly conducive. So in the Abhidhamma, they have the word upanisaya as upanisaya pachaya, and this is upanisar is actually a contraction of that, has basically the same meaning. Right, so something which is upanisaya is something which is closely dependent but in an active way, not just a necessary condition but an actively supporting condition. One of the ordinary language examples of what that means is that a monastic is said to be living upanisaya on a local village. Right, so you're living in dependence on that local village. So there's a necessary relation on that, but it's also the village doesn't just happen to be there, right? But the village is like actively providing that support for you to be able to be there. So upanisaya always has this kind of sense of being strongly conducive, not just a necessary, but strongly conducive. So this is why I translate it as a vital condition, trying to convey both of these aspects, that it's both necessary and conducive, like it like pushes it forward. Elsewhere, the word upanisar is used for the seven path factors as vital conditions for right immersion or samadhi. There's also another distinct sense of upanisar as being sitting close to a teacher. Now, it's not clear if upanisar is the same as the Sanskrit Upanishad. So those of you who come to my talks will know that I always often referring to the Upanishads as the closest literature to the time of the Buddha and literature with which the Buddha was very familiar and to which he was often responding. So the word Upanishad, the oldest meaning of the word Upanishad is of a correspondence or equivalence. So an Upanishad is something where one thing is something else, usually some kind of hidden link between things. So this originated in the idea of doing the ritual. So you might, for example, an obvious example of this would be that you light the fire and that fire is really the sun. Okay, so that is very obvious. That's too obvious for Vedic poets. They'd be like, yeah, you get a C for that. It's true, but it's very boring. Okay, C minus maybe for your poetry. So if you say your fire is like red horses, okay, now you're doing better. Okay, we'll give you like a B for that, right? So there's these hidden connections and they want to find those links. So you can see that it has something to do with this Buddhist idea that these things are also linked to each other. Right, so it's not like a completely different idea, but still it's not exactly sure whether they're the same words or whether they should be considered the same words. Anyway, so this is upanisar. This is the word that's used here, and it's normally not used in the context of dependent origination, but it's specifically used here in the context of that practice because it's talking about those factors that are strongly conducive. Okay, any questions so far? Yes, no? Not yet. All right. All right, so first of all, we have the knowledge and vision of the ending of defilements. Okay, so this is now starting to give us some insight into the structure of enlightenment. All right? Yeah? Knowledge, the condition for knowledge and vision is freedom. All right? So what is the difference here, right? So if we say, well, I have the knowledge that all of my defilements are ended, that there's I've got no attachments left, that there's nothing which is binding me to samsara, right? Isn't that just the same thing as freedom? Right? Why does the Buddha says freedom is then the condition for this thing? It can't be the same thing. If they were the same thing, one thing couldn't be the condition. Freedom is the condition for knowing and seeing of the ending of defilements. Why are they different? Something to ponder. Okay, so when the Buddha's talking about this thing of the knowledge and vision of the ending of defilements, he's talking about reviewing knowledge, okay? So the moment of freedom happens, you're free. The moment of freedom, in this case, is the freedom of arahantship, happens in an instant. You're either chained or you're not, right? Then after you're chained, you can then reflect back on that, especially in deep meditation. And you can review and you know clearly that this is the case, that all of those things that are binding you to suffering, they're all gone. Yeah? So this is why those two things are different. The freedom itself, the liberation itself, is the moment where you let go of all of those things that are binding you to suffering. The knowledge and vision of that is the reflection on that and the awareness that that has happened, right? So this is interesting. This is telling us something about the structure of enlightenment. Yeah. I'm just wondering if I should go in the forward order or backwards order. I should probably go in the backwards order because I've got the notes here. Hi. Please come and join us. We're just doing a meditation class at the moment. We're just in the middle of it, so I apologize if things don't make sense. No, that's okay? No, not at all. Welcome. Yeah. All right. Fine. So we've got freedom. So that's sounding pretty good. Okay? So far, so good. Who doesn't like freedom? Anyone? Anyone who likes not being free? Okay? Now, freedom is like... much abused these days, right? The idea of freedom is often put to service for things that are decidedly unfree. But of course, when the Buddha meant freedom, he meant real freedom, obviously. And he didn't just mean freedom to do whatever the hell you wanted, right? He meant the freedom to be free from desires, free from being trapped by getting what you want and having what you want. So the immediate cause of freedom is dispassion, what we call viraga. And viraga both means the absence of desire or lust or passion, as well as the fading away of the colouring of the mind. So dispassion has a vital condition, disillusionment, nibbida. So nibbida, I actually gave a talk on this at Crow's Nest a few weeks ago, and nibbida has the kind of sense of like a turning away from something. Here's the thing. So if I've got this water bottle here, I don't know if everybody can see this, I'm trying to make it sober, and I can kind of let go of it, but letting go of it kind of isn't just quite enough. There needs to be some kind of force to actually push it away, to actually become separate from things. There needs to be something there. Like a nibbida is almost like a kind of a negative polarity on a magnet. You know, if you put the two poles the same and they kind of push each other apart. So nibbida is that point that separates the mind from defilements and from all those things that are bringing suffering.
Repentance.
Sorry? Repentance. It's not really repentance. Repentance, no. Repentance is a moral reflection. This is nibbida is it's almost like an automatic emotion that happens like through reflection and so on. Like it's more similar to something like let's say you decondition. Just say you like cigarettes, and then you sort of decondition yourself to liking cigarettes, and you just sort of every time you see one, you go, yuck, that's horrible. I actually did this when I first became a vegetarian. And so I just conditioned myself to whenever I see meat, I would just go, ew, that's horrible. And then I'd just like think about the animal that was being killed and the blood and all of these kinds of things. And it didn't take long till I wasn't interested in eating meat anymore. So that's that kind of condition. So there needs to be that kind of energy that's going to push your mind away from something. And that's what we call nibbida. It also has a sense almost of boredom, like you're just losing interest in something. Yeah. So there's a simile where there's like a jackal that's coming around and poking at the tortoise and trying to get the nice flesh inside the tortoise, but the tortoise brings his limbs and head in and hides there and in the shell, the jackal kind of pokes around and so on, can't find an entrance, so wanders off nibbida, right? Wanders off with nibbida. So there's a certain kind of sense of boredom there as well. So that's disillusionment. Turning away in disappointment upon realizing one cannot get what one wants. So what's the difference between nibbida and viraga? So nibbida is an earlier stage in the process, right? So nibbida is the turning away, and then when viraga is then there's the almost like the dying of that passion for that thing. So if nibbida is like when there's an energy that's pushing you away, it kind of implies that there's an energy pulling you to it as well. Right? That's why you need the energy to push you away. So nibbida is not yet entirely free of desire. Like even that jackal, right? Think about it. Jackal's like, oh, I can't get in there. I'm going to turn away. But if it had seen, oh, look, maybe I've got a chance, right? He'd be in there again. So the desire is actually not completely gone, but it's being let go of. It's in that process of being let go of. So this process of the next item is truly knowing and seeing. So this is the insight of stream entry. Notice the difference between truly knowing and seeing here, yathabhuta jnana dasana, and at the beginning we had the knowing and seeing of the ending of defilements. And this distinction is made consistently throughout the suttas. If we just have knowing and seeing, or truly knowing and seeing or something, it's usually stream entry. And if it's knowing and seeing of the ending of defilements, it's arahantship. So that's really useful to be able to recognize that distinction so that you know which one is being talked about. Okay, so these series of dhammas, so we've got truly knowing and seeing, and then disillusionment, and then dispassion, and then freedom. These four dhammas, we find these constantly throughout the suttas, sometimes with slight variations, and they're describing that process of deep insight and liberating realization. Okay, and so this, in a way, became the template for all of the later Buddhist theories of insight meditation and the progress of insight and development of wisdom and so on. And so if we look at things like, say, the Vipassana jnanas in the Visuddhimagga, or similar kinds of systems and things like the Abhidharma Kosha, then we can see that they all draw upon this same dynamic in some kind of way. First of all, seeing how it really is. Oh, you get a vision of it, then you turn away from it. And when you've turned away from it, you lose interest in it, and then you're free from it. And when you're free from it, you can then reflect back and know that you're free. Now, in this sutta, of course, the Buddha is speaking to a very high level. He's talking about enlightenment. And so because he's talking about enlightenment, this is like absolute. Like when the Buddha's talking about being free, he means really being free. But the dynamic that the Buddha is talking about applies all the time. And you can see that, you know, whenever we're just doing whatever you want, you know. You can see it if you go walk past the cheesecake shop and you go, yeah, that looks nice. And you think, oh, I'll just check the ingredients. And so then you check the ingredients and like, oh, now I'm knowing and seeing what's really in this thing. Starting to feel a bit of nibbida. And so you put it down, turn away, and then as you turn away, then your mind loses interest in it, and then you're free from it, right? You can see it's actually that same kind of process. This is the way that Dhamma always works. These are not like special mystical things that just happen to somebody who's fully enlightened. They're just ordinary things that happen all the time. And what the Buddha is saying is that these ordinary things that happen all the time are in fact the same things that lead to Nibbana, when they are developed to their fullest degree. And again, remember that simile, like the water coming down the mountaintop is just working with the nature of reality as it is. Okay, so then the next one. Okay, fine. So we want to see truly. How do we see truly? With immersion, samadhi. So immersion is a general term for the absorptions and other profound meditations free of the hindrances. This is from my comment here. See, there's a typo there I'll have to fix. It's an integrated, samadhi is an integrated emotional state of elevated consciousness during which the mind is extremely bright and powerful. For a meditator with right view, the empowered mind emerging from immersion naturally inclines towards insight into the suffering of holding on and the bliss of letting go. So this is a summary of the role of samadhi in the Buddhist path. Notice that I said there that for a meditator with right view. So remember that right samadhi comes as a result of right view. So if you're practicing with wrong view, then you might get samadhi, but it will be wrong samadhi. And this is a point, I think, which a lot of people seem to be very confused about. Samadhi means jhanas. Right samadhi is jhanas. Wrong samadhi is also jhanas. Wrong samadhi is not the absence of samadhi, okay? Having a distracted mind is not wrong samadhi. It's the absence of samadhi, okay? That's just not samadhi, right? Wrong samadhi is genuinely samadhi, but it is simply samadhi that does not lead to liberation. That's it. That's why it's wrong. It doesn't mean it's bad, right? In the same way that wrong view doesn't mean a bad view. If somebody has a belief, I believe that there is an eternal loving God and my life should be lived as a homage to that loving God by spreading as much love as I can for all sentient beings, this is not a bad view, right? It's a beautiful view. It's a lovely and inspiring view. And if somebody lived according to that, they would live a really good life. But according to the Buddha, it's wrong because there is not, in fact, a loving and eternal God. Sorry, we've got a bunch of Hindu statues here. I'm just hoping we don't get any thunderbolts coming down at the moment, but they seem to be pretty good. So make sure to understand, like, wrong view doesn't necessarily mean a bad view as such, right? It's not necessarily pernicious or harmful, but it does have a mistaken understanding about how the world is. So if you practice according to that view, you can get into samadhi. And we know that, you know, there are great sages from Hinduism, from the Sufis, from Christianity, from, like, in China, ancient China, the Taoists and so on. Now, it's very difficult to say who's doing what, okay? It's the same thing with, like, Aboriginal people. Aboriginal people were doing contemplative meditations and these kinds of things. And some people like to say, oh, you know, they were getting in jhanas or they were doing this. And I think, okay, cool. I don't really have any opinions about that. But I will tell you that as a meditation teacher, if I'm on a meditation retreat and I'm teaching people and I'm talking to them every day about their meditation, it's not easy to know who has got jhana and who doesn't. And so I'm not telling the people on my retreats what they've got because it's not really very useful. And it's hard to know in many cases. In some cases, it's very obvious, right? But in a lot of cases, it's not. So I'm not making any particular statements about what different sages and so on have. But it certainly does seem to be the case that there are many sages of contemplative traditions around the world who did realize these profound states of meditation. Why not? It is just the natural state of the mind. So this samadhi is a vital condition for knowing and seeing things as they really are. And this is the mainstream position of early Buddhism found countless times throughout the suttas. And I know that in modern times, a lot of people, incredible amount of energy has been expended in the 20th and 21st century to try to argue that you don't really need jhanas to get liberated. So I wrote a book about that many years ago called Swift Pair of Messengers. And then I did a little bit of research to write an appendix for that book. And then that turned into a book that was twice as big and four times as complicated called If History is Mindfulness. And So then I left it there. I answered that question to my own satisfaction anyway. So, I mean, to me, it seems like that jhanas are taught so centrally and so often and so fundamentally in the Buddhist, right throughout the Buddhist teachings, that the real question is not, are jhanas necessary? The real question is, why have so many people spent so much time and so much effort to try to prove something that is so obvious and straightforward? Anyway, moving along. So, okay, fine. So we get jhanas, great. Then we see things as they are. We see things as they are. We become disillusioned. We turn away. Our desire, attachment fades. We become free. We can reflect on that. Fine. That's great. How do we get samadhi? Right? The next one. Okay, how do we get samadhi? Question number one. Do we get samadhi because of a particular meditation technique? Do we get samadhi because we follow a particular teacher? Do we get samadhi because we do nothing but meditate all day, every day? Do we get samadhi because we can force ourselves to sit through pain? Do we get samadhi because we get a special blessing from someone or something? Do we get samadhi because we've got exactly the right meditation cushion? Okay? Now, all of those things may or may not be helpful at one point, right? But that's not what the Buddha is saying here. The Buddha says, why do you get samadhi? Bliss, yeah? Sukha. So when translating the words, Pali word sukha, we sometimes translate it as bliss, sometimes pleasure, sometimes happiness. And in this case, we're talking about a beautiful, deep, pervasive, lasting, and subtle sense of pleasure that is imbued and saturated through the whole energetic and experiential field of your body and mind. And this is what we call bliss. It's very stable. It has a very sweet kind of color to it, very sweet kind of taste to it. And it draws the mind to a sense of settledness, draws the mind in. You're not restless, because why would you be? You're perfectly happy here, right? So when I'm trying to teach meditation, this is one of the main things we're trying to emphasize. You know, when I first heard Ajahn Brahm's teachings many years ago, and I heard him talking about bliss, he was one of the first teachers that in the kind of international Dhamma realm anyway, who really started emphasizing the importance of the emotional connection with the breath. A lot of the time before that, it'd been much more cognitive, it'd been much more rational, and the breath is more treated as this kind of object that you pay attention to and this kind of effort and striving. And Ajahn Brahm, I remember one talk he did where he talked about you hold the breath like you're holding a newborn baby, and you hold the breath in your arms like this little baby, and you just love it so much, and you hold it with such care and such tenderness. And that bringing of that emotional dimension into the breath was something that really changed the way that I looked at meditation, and I think the way a lot of people looked at meditation. Now, in those early years when I was first a Bodhnyana, you know, I heard Ajahn Brahm giving these various teachings. Honestly, I kind of thought it was a bit much. Like, I thought he was emphasizing jhanas and stuff a bit too much. But then the more I studied the suttas, the more I realized, no, he actually emphasizes it about the same amount as the suttas do. So, so bliss or sukha leads to samadhi. Samadhi leads to seeing things as they really are. That leads to turning away from them. That leads to dispassion. That leads to freedom. And then you can reflect and know what that freedom is. So what then leads to bliss? Right?
Tranquility,
pasadhi. Very good. Yeah. So tranquility. Now, so tranquility has two aspects in meditation, mental and physical tranquility. You can experience the beginnings of physical tranquility even in a short meditation on the breath. So just now we did 20 minutes meditation on the breath, and I'm sure probably for most of you, hopefully all of you, you would have found that at the end of the meditation that your breath is quieter and more peaceful than it was at the beginning, right? That's tranquility. That's pasadhi. That's the beginnings of it, right? It still has got a long way to go. When pasadhi is very deep, it's almost like a kind of molasses. It's almost like it has this. It's you're almost like stuck, like movement is gone. like you just don't want to go anywhere. Yeah. So you're still not completely unified. So the unified mind coming into itself and resting within its own radiance. This is what samadhi is. Tranquility is not as profound as that, but there's still just this stillness and contentment of the mind. And it's not just like tranquility is funny because it's not just like an absence of restlessness, but it's a presence of tranquility. Like it feels like something which is filling you with this stillness. Okay, tranquility. So great, that sounds good. How do we get tranquility? Rapture or piti. Okay, so rapture is a heightened emotional response to happiness or joy. Minor forms of rapture appear as tingling or thrill, and it deepens into a pervasive spiritual sense of elevation or uplift in meditation. So the word piti, essentially, the key here is that it's the emotional response. Okay, so when you're meditating, maybe you feel like a tingling, maybe you feel like an excitement, all of these things. These are forms of piti. But the piti that we're aiming for, the rapture that we're aiming for, and by the way, we're going to float up to heaven and leave all the sinners behind kind of rapture, okay? It's a different kind of rapture. It's not that one, right? So, but there's a feeling of uplift, okay? So tranquility is almost like down. Tranquility is settling and solid. Rapture is uplifting. So what causes rapture? So joy or paramoja. Difficult, of course, to capture the nuances of these, but paramoja is sometimes translated as gladness. So paramoja is the upwelling of happiness connected with wholesome things, like hearing the Dhamma or reflecting in your progress or on your own ethical purity. So there can be many sources of paramoja. Also, like mudita is from a related term. So if you like reflecting on people's success or people's goodness, any kind of normal, wholesome sense of happiness can be a source of that joy or what we call paramoja. So paramoja, again, is an ordinary, everyday emotion. It's not as like a specialized meditation thing. It's just that feeling of joy. So we have to cultivate that sense of joy in the life to be able to see that. And if we have eyes to see, we can see joy all around us. We can see joy in the skies and in the trees. We can see joy in the little children and the puppies. We can see joy in the kind words that neighbors say to one another. And so if we can notice these things, you can find joy anywhere. When you're stuck in the traffic, you can reflect on how wonderful it is that people turn their indicators on before they're turning. Like normally we just get angry when they don't turn the indicators on, but like 9 times out of 10, they do turn them on, and we just ignore that. So you can do like, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you so much for putting your indicator on. And then you have that kind of happiness. And you realize that we actually lose so many opportunities. Because it is, it's a point of consideration. It's politeness to people around you. So we lose so many opportunities to care for people around you. It's something I always like to do if you're walking around the city or something like that, you see somebody working, maybe someone like cleaning the toilets or picking up rubbish or something like that, you always just say thank you to them, you know? It's a thankless, hard job, right? Just say, oh, look, thanks for helping keeping the place clean. And so this is one way that we can bring joy to ourselves and joy to others. I remember one time I got on a bus at Central Station. We're going out to the Buddhist Library, and this guy got on the bus, and he said, look, I just want to make an announcement. I just want to let people know that all the men are handsome and all the women are beautiful. And the driver is like really good at his job, and so you can just relax and take it easy because he's going to take us safely to where we need to go. And everyone just gave him this big cheer and everyone was happy. So joy is everywhere around us. Okay. So joy has a vital condition. And what is that vital condition? It's faith, right? So faith is, of course, in Buddhism is always grounded faith, right? The akaravati sadha. Not a blind faith and not like an absolute faith, but a faith which is based on reason and experience. But faith has irreducibly an emotional connection, right? So faith is something that gives us some inspiration, and it's something that we can, like, in a sense, faith is inexplicable. It's connected to things in ways that you can't really understand. like people feel inspired by different things. Maybe they feel inspired by a particular religion or a particular path or a particular teacher. And there's some connection there which at an emotional level that you can't necessarily rationalize. But at the same time, we can still cultivate faith, especially by noticing those things that give rise to that wholesome faith and by cultivating those things. And so faith arises from suffering, as I mentioned before. So faith arises from suffering. So elsewhere, the Buddha says that somebody who suffers has one of two outcomes, either despair or a search. Yeah. So when we fall into suffering, we fall into despair, or we embark on a search. Kind of interesting pair there, because they're not exactly symmetrical. So when you fall into despair, that's almost like a giving up of the will to do anything. You know, you're just like, that's it. I'm gone. I'm done. You're overwhelmed. Like, it's like the suffering has squashed you, has crushed you. Whereas the search is something which is difficult, right? And especially, you know, you have to find like what is true, and you have to look for what is meaningful. And it's actually something that you have to do. It's not going to be given to you. It's not going to be just handed to you on a platter. And this is, I think, you know, one of the great fallacies of modern day information system. We think we can put all the information out there. We make the information available to people. Therefore, people will be better informed. Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. They get worse informed, right? Why? Because, well, sometimes it's just because you're lazy and you just want to get whatever some machine is going to tell you is the truth, rather than the hard-won truth of experience. So that search for where can I hear somebody who can tell me a word that can free me from this suffering? And then when you hear the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha talks about suffering, and you say, yes, that's what happened to me. I'm suffering. The Buddha's talking about suffering. Oh, that's real. And so you feel seen because he's talking about that real experience that we all have. So this is why faith comes, listening to the Buddha's teachings. So we should never shy away from talking about suffering in Buddhism, right? Suffering is the thing that creates that connection and gives rise to faith. Suffering is a condition into what we've born, but the experience of suffering is also the stimulus we need to seek freedom. So here we are now linking from those who have, right? So far, right? We're talking about people who have embarked on the path, right? Who are going to go through that series of conditions. And now we're coming back to dependent origination itself. Suffering is a condition, rebirth or jati. And we now go back from jati to bhava to grasping and so on through all the 12 conditions of dependent origination, which we have discussed in previous talks. And if you weren't there, they are at lokanta.live, so you can go and check all those ones out. But the main point here is that dependent origination is giving us our existential situation. It's telling us that we have landed here. All of the conditions from the past, all of our choices, all of our attachments, all of our desires have thrust us through samsara and have driven our course through samsara, and they've landed us here somehow in this world where we just have to deal with it, you know? And it's so easy to get lost. And, of course, that's what most of us do most of the time. And, you know, even those of us who are trying to find the path, even we can get very easily lost a lot of the time. But that path of the Dhamma, when we can find that path of the Dhamma, then it leads us to liberation and it leads us to freedom. And just from that recapitulation, from rebirth, gives to suffering to faith to joy, joy to rapture to tranquility to bliss to immersion to truly knowing and seeing to disillusionment, then disillusionment to dispassion to freedom. And then that's like the water flowing down from the mountaintops. So if we can, in a way, like tune into that natural process through understanding that situation that we've landed in because of dependent origination, then we are already starting to begin that process of freedom from suffering. Elsewhere, the Buddha gave similar teachings and he used phrases like dhammata esa, it's only natural. Yeah, it's only natural that one who has faith will give rise to joy. It's only natural that one who has joy will give rise to. And another phrase that he uses in this context, he says that there's no need to make a wish. And so if you have faith, then there's no need to make a wish to experience joy. It's natural. It's no need to make a wish to experience rapture. It's natural that you'll experience rapture. So the path, once we're on the path, leads us to the ocean. It leads us to freedom. I like that sound that Jitsi makes. Sorry, everybody online. I'm not exactly sure what happened, but it seems that our phone was just phoning it in and then decided to no longer phone it in. So hopefully, it says 40, so hopefully it was only a minute or two that we missed out. So anyway, we had reached the end of the discussion for today and the end of the discussion for dependent origination. So hopefully at the end of a long lost in the weeds of technicalities and philosophical debates and so on and so forth, hopefully this evening's talk was a bit more showing you that inspiration, that sense of inspiration. So the purpose of dependent origination is not, as it might seem, to make you suffer more. No, that's not the purpose. The purpose is to find freedom from suffering. And in the Upanishad Sutta, the Buddha is giving us the way to do that. Okay, so any questions before we wrap up for this evening? Yeah.
Just thought I'd ask, you know how the insight happens when you come out of samadhi?
Right.
Is that, that's not explicit though, is it, in the suttas? Or is it?
Well, it uses the word, interestingly enough, the word that it uses in the suttas to talk about insight after samadhi is the same word that's used for the tortoise and its shell.
Right.
Right. Remember, I talked about the jackal with the tortoise. So it actually uses the word samadhati, like the same word for the jackal, for the tortoise withdrawing all his limbs.
Right.
Right? So it's the five limbs, four legs and the head, like the five senses withdrawn. Mm-hmm. And then you project them out again.
Right.
So it uses that same abhininna meti to project out. The same verb is used in the sort of, in the description of samadhi. Yeah, it's interesting. Okay, I think another quote. Pei.
Regarding the joy, if we focus on, you know, daily practice, if you just focus on joy and like,
right,
will that take you all the way to samadhi and nirvana?
Try it and see. I think you probably have to do some meditation as well. So Pei's asking whether you can just focus on wholesome joy and whether that will lead you all the way. But don't even worry about questions like that, right? If you have an opportunity to find joy through some wholesome, then you do it. That's all, you know? And the more that you do all of these things, then the more the mind will incline towards freedom. That's all. Yeah. No. But you still have to meditate. Yeah. Again, the wrong samadhi is samadhi with wrong view. Okay, so it's not about the type of samadhi. So I think Jose, is that right?
So this sutta explains all the way to arahantship. So it's
that's correct. Yeah.
But for example, it goes all the way to samadhi. There is some insight. But where does it stop?
Sorry, for the stream enterer?
Yeah. Because.
Sorry, this phone's ringing just here.
It will have some
fingers,
yeah? So it doesn't go all the way. Like the stream entry, it doesn't go all the way.
Right, so the stream entry is the knowledge and vision of things as they are, right?
But not freedom?
But not freedom, no. Typically, that's correct, yeah. I mean, of course, you can say that stream entry is free from the fetters that they've let go of and so on and so forth. So in a certain, you know, they're free to a certain degree. But in that case, it's using freedom to mean free from all defilements, yeah. Okay? Good. Any other?
Just with regards to you know, these mystics from the other tradition,
like, yes,
the Christian mystics.
And, yeah.
So could we say that they would have to have a high degree of ethics to be able to get to that, right?
Generally speaking, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So the question was whether ascetics from other religions would have to have a high degree of ethics to get into samadhi. Generally speaking, unless you're kind of, I mean, these things are always complex, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you might be kind of surfing on the wave of your past karma.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that happens.
Fair
enough. Yeah.
But, okay. But it's just that the...
So he's been calling for quite some time now, so it may be important.
No,
you sure? Okay. All right,
but it's just that, so obviously they don't have the right kind of doctrine, I guess.
That's right, yeah, the understanding, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. A pagan,
Last question. Regarding the turning away from, like, this passion and turning away, is
that
referring to, like, the notion of self?
In what way do you mean?
Knowing, like, the inside of knowing there is no self.
Right? Right?
Is that what it's referring to?
Yeah, because when you're so the question was whether the turning away and the nibbida is to do with understanding not self, right? So normally we're kind of attached to and we identify things. If you just take that very simple example I said before about seeing the cheesecake, right? So you walk past it. This is one of the reasons why being monastic is really good, because you walk past it and you haven't got any money. So you can sort of sit there and gaze longingly through the window of the cheesecake shop for as long as you like, but it's not going to do you any good, right? So as long as you have that idea, oh, that could be mine, right, then your attachment starts to work, right? Because you start to think, oh yeah, maybe that could be mine, yeah, and then that kind of goes, yeah. So this is very linked up with the idea of self, yeah, very much so. Please, no.
I just have a comment. Just like throw it in there, like just so that, I don't know, just people think about things in ways. When you said that we hear in the teachings that there's either despair or a beginning of a search, I just want to say that you can have despair then.
For sure. I mean, usually it's a matter of degree, right? How far you go down into despair before the search comes, right? Yeah, that's probably, yeah, for sure. All right, so there's just a couple of questions online. Let me just address those briefly. We'll have to wrap up for this evening. So Tess asks, is dependent origination the same as dependent arising? Yes, it's just a different translation. For the positive sequence, like leading from suffering towards liberation, I coined the term dependent liberation for that some time ago. So you might see that around the place. It's caught on a little bit. There's no sort of standard technical term for that. Actually, it's kind of funny that teaching of that like unfolding of liberation in that natural way, we find that taught a number of times in the suttas. But it feels like it kind of got lost a little bit, like in terms of like emphasis, because it never got its own sangyutta. So there's not a particular chapter dedicated to it, and it doesn't have a particular like major sutta like the Satipatthana Sutta or something like that. But most of the teachings on that theme are actually in the Anguttara Nikaya, which is probably the least read of all of the Nikayas. And they're kind of just like a few suttas here and there. And so it seems that teaching was not, the centrality of it was not quite recognized. In the Chinese Agamas, we find that teaching actually more often and more prominent. It's taught in a number of Majjhima suttas. So it's the same basic teaching, but the way that they've organized it, I think in Pali, probably just accidentally, has ended up with that teaching being underemphasized, I think. Anyway, I call it dependent liberation. So Kristen asks, is the same time next Friday? That's correct. The time is always the same, but time always changes. So there's that. Uh-huh. Yeah, we're always Friday, 7 o'clock Sydney time. But yeah, we just had daylight savings. So I'm sorry about that. So that did change for an hour. Sorry for those who missed out. I should have mentioned it last week. Venerable Nirodha gives thanks. Thank you, Venerable. And yeah, there's also daylight saving happening in some places in Europe and America. So yeah, feels like we should really be getting over daylight saving, but yeah, anyway. So Venerable Prasanna mentions that Ajahn Kovalo compiled all the dependent liberation suttas into a book called The Wellbeing Cascade. Nice. Okay. Nice way of putting it as well. All right. Thank you so much, everybody. Oh, just remind you the details. Venerable Prasanna will be here next week. Next Wednesday, we're cancelled at Crow's Nest. The Pindabhata will be cancelled Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and I'll be back after that. Santi Katina is on this Sunday, Lankarama Katina on Saturday. Santi, our Katina is on the 25th. You can see the Lokanta website. And the Metta Center Metta Conference is on the 8th and 9th of November. Thank you, Sinsin. So do check out the Metta Center website for the conference and for all of the details of the many events that's happening around then. Thank you so much, everybody. See you again next time. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.